Bang, bang, I hit the ground. Bang, bang, that awful sound. Bang, bang, my baby shot me down.
Well, that's a little Paul Capsis there. He is one of Australia's most versatile performers. He's been across so many stages. He's worked internationally. He's a singer. He's an actor. He's so much more than all of that. He recently was on at the Opera House Live, which you can still see online. We'll get a bit more into that in just a bit, but welcome to Stages, Paul Capsis.
Hello, Regina.
Hello. So he's ever so magnetic and glamorous. I saw a little bit of the online performance, but before we get into that, we want to find out a little bit about who you are and, you know, how you got to be where you are in such a dynamic and versatile performer. So where did you begin life?
Surrey Hills, Sydney.
Oh.
I was born in Crown Street Women's Hospital, which is now the Adina Hotel.
And so what was life like growing up for you in Surrey Hills?
When I was growing up, it was incredibly different to what it is now. It's funny, though. It's kind of coming back to how it was. It's becoming a rough place again. When I was a child, it was working class. It was rough. There were a lot of factories. It was completely and utterly multicultural. It was dominated by Greeks, Italians, Maltese, Yugoslavian, Portuguese, Spanish, Aboriginal, and some white people. Yeah, so it was very different. There were no cafes, yeah. There were no trees, there was no clover moor, there was no lovely greenery around. People had a view of the place that it was dangerous and dirty. Mm. We were the suburb next to next to Redfern, which was even more dangerous and more frightening a place. So yeah, I grew up with, that's the Surrey Hills I grew up with.
Yeah. So were your parents creative at all? Were they influential in your sort of development as a singer or performer, would you say?
I always performed as a child. I was desperately seeking attention, and it would manifest itself in me on the spot trying to dance rock and roll really fast. Like my family, obviously, because they're older generation, they were sort of more influenced by the 50s rock and roll, like Little Richard and Elvis Presley. So my whole thing when I was a kid to get attention was to really dance fast, and all my aunties and be like, "What? Oh my God, he's gonna collapse!" Because I would dance really fast and make my face bright red. So I was always, yeah, looking for attention, I guess, in a big Maltese Greek family. And that kind of was the beginning. And I guess in a sense, I wasn't told not to perform. As a child, it was kind of cute and funny. But then, of course, when I got older and became enamored by the world of arts, performing, then it was like, oh, you mean you're not going to sell fruit and work in the factory and scrub toilets?
Yeah.
So my answer to that was no.
So that was what was expected?
Yeah. I mean, indirectly, there was always music. I mean, that's something that I'm very grateful for.
Mm.
My mother's music tastes were Black African-American music. She loved Otis Redding, The Supremes, and people like that, Aretha Franklin. So my mother had all this kind of music playing. And my dad had his music, which was Andy Williams and Greek music. But the Greek music that he played was of the Arabic influence Greek music. So that was something that always caught my ear, was the way the rebetika, the way that the Greek, ancient Greeks sang, which was that in a very different kind of style, very free flowing, which is pretty much like a lot of folk music from other cultures. Like if you listen to Fado Portuguese, or if you listen to Anna, the Maltese folk, there's, and also the early Spanish music, there's a way, the flamenco, the way of singing, it is very raw, that kind of music. So I suppose in a way, indirectly, my family did influence me.
Is that Fado or Greek, or what you're saying the influence is? Is it somehow more guttural, like?
Yeah, Fado is Portuguese, and that's their kind of folk I mean, for me, I'm a bit obsessed with this Spanish singer called Cameron de la Isla, who's one of the great singers of the world, and largely unknown, I guess, now. But he's one of my favorite singers. I don't even understand mostly what he's singing. I never understand what he's singing, but I can listen to him all day long. And there's just something about the way this man sang, and it does something to me, to my core. It gives me strength. Isn't that incredible that as someone who uses voice, who you don't really even understand the words, can do that to you? I mean, I imagine that's from, well, something about my early obsession with Janis Joplin from the age of 12 was something about the way she sang and the rawness and the style. And that did something to my core, which gave me some kind of a strength. It's the same when I listen to Tina Turner's early recordings or Mahalia Jackson. People have a way of singing that for me gives me life, which is why in this point in time in Australia, in the way we're being treated by our government and our cultural artistic community has been attacked by the Liberal government against us because we are artists. Always goes back to the core of what a singer, the power of a voice can do to people, and how a singer can galvanize. A singer can save your life, and singers have saved my life.
Is there a particular moment that is absolutely apt for you? I mean, was there a moment that you recall especially that was hard and that you had music to bring you up?
Well, earliest memory of that, and it happens throughout my life, it happens now. It's the thing that helps me, gets me through. Apart from friends and reaching out to dear friends who are loyal and give you inspiration when you feel down, like we are, a lot of us are right
At the
now in
moment,
this point in time. But earliest for me was by accident. I don't even know how it happened. Well, I do know how it happened because I think about how things happen in my life and then what they've subsequently how they've influenced me. And one of the things was when I went through school, unfortunately, because of my natural feminine qualities in my personality, which are natural, there are things I was born with, and I was persecuted for those things because I sounded, wait for it, female. So I never got that email, but the email apparently said you can't be that, and if you are, you're going to be persecuted. So the thing that got me through was particular singers, and it started with an obsession with Tina Turner when she was with Ike, her husband Ike, and the way she sang, and Susie Quattro. And then as a result, through those people, I ended up finding Janis Joplin, which she'd already been dead when I found her. And that rawness and pain that she embraced in her singing, which she drew on from her life experience, it just did something to me that kept me hanging in there. It kept me strong. It kept me positive. It kept me adamant that I would pursue myself and allow myself to be who I am, and regardless of what people think.
It's interesting that you obviously born, like you say, in Surry Hills in a very multicultural kind of area, and yet there is this undercurrent of, like you say, homophobia and also racism. Can you talk a little bit about how you have seen that maybe change over your time as a performer on stage and whether you've come up against that in the performance world?
Well, the thing about it now is when you get older, because when we become adults, I mean, children are incredibly, what's the word? They can be cruel
Cruel
to each
each
other.
other.
Well, that was my experience. You know, they don't hold back. They're incredibly honest, and they react and act out. And for all sorts of reasons, I also, when I thought about what happened to me, I also was empathetic towards those boys because it was, 99.9% boys who were violent. That only later in my life was I able to be empathetic towards their predicament and their situation, which was that they were being taught that violence. They were being brainwashed with those ideas about what is right and what is acceptable, that a boy who has a feminine voice could be so upsetting to them. And that's not homophobia, that's misogyny. Because the thing that was disgraceful, as I discovered, was that I sounded like a female. It wasn't about being homosexual. It was that I was female. I was male, but I was presenting as female. So that was the worst thing you could be. And then later, of course, that was associated with homosexuality. So then, yes, it became homophobic after it was. Now, when I think about those early days when I was being attacked for sounding female, was because that was misogyny.
And that natural paradigm is to dominate.
Yeah, and I guess the thing about it is that what people adults learn to do is they become covert. They hide those traits and they manifest in different ways. In, for example, if a woman is homophobic or a woman is misogynist and someone presents to her in that way in their character and she has a position of power where she can cast you or not, to me that's their covert way of getting you or attacking you or blocking you or stopping you. And that is still prevalent in our community, in the Australian arts community. As a person who's been doing this for 38 years, I still see that discrimination. I still see that wielding of privilege and power. It's changing very slightly, and there are wonderful things happening as well. There are, wonderful TV series that are presented with Indigenous characters as the central characters, which is a relief that we're finally getting this, but there are still many in our culture and community in Australia who are neglected, who are invisible. I think it's going to take multiple generations. In a way, I don't want to think about that.
No.
Because hopefully I'll be dead.
And it will be someone else's burden to carry and to try and change and to have an influence over. But you have done a lot of influencing. You have told your story on stage where you're from. Was there a particular moment that you recall becoming enamored as a performer? Was there a turning point that you went, this is it, I'm doing this for this forever?
For me, it was a really slow burn, a lot of doubt, a lot of brainwashing with the negativity about what it is to be a performer, to be in the arts. I came from working class family, on both sides, my Greek side and my Maltese side. So they knew hard physical labor, benefits of focus and dedication to your work in a physical way, right? And, of course, like many of us, I was that generation that the hope that we would propel into a higher level, for example, to become a banker or a lawyer or a doctor, and nobody in my family ever got to that. But being a performer was very strange, very not understood idea in terms of how one can survive.
Well, it is hard, isn't it?
I had many, many, many little incidences along the way that manifested eventually into something that became my career. I had a wish. I had a desire to be a singer in a band. I wanted to be like my idols. I wanted to have that kind of career. But then I looked around me and I looked and, oh, there's nobody like me in Australia doing that kind of thing. The only people that are doing that in Australia are white heterosexual people. And I'm looking at examples of people that I actually loved, people like the band Skyhooks, men, straight white men who wore makeup and sang really kinky songs. There was Jeff Duff in Kush. And there was a period where it looked like Australia was going to be quite advanced in expression and that kind of thing. And then, of course, all these wonderful theatrical people came up, people like Reg Livermore and Robin Archer, who were queer and who were flamboyant, Australian, Anglo, big difference. But they were there. So that the fact that they were there meant that they opened many doors for many of us later. The thing is, you just have to keep going. And that's the thing I've learned from my family. The church bells rang.
Hey. You're listening to Stages. I'm Regina Botras, and I am talking with Paul Capsis. So you have been working recently, and I had a look at the online Opera House Live. Must have been a very interesting experience to be in the Opera House, to be performing in such, because you have this massively big personality, you know, it's glamorous, it's engaging with an audience, but you were there without an audience. How was that to perform the Opera House Live?
One of the most surreal, bizarre, strange experiences of my 38 years as a performer. I mean, literally, from the minute I arrived at the Opera House. First of all, I want to go back. When I got the call, it was about a week. They said, in a week, could you come? And I went, oh, wait a minute. I'm on pause. Someone in China ate a bat. And I'm on pause. So I don't know. Everything's gone. Everything's disappeared. Mm. I was literally paralyzed, physically paralyzed by this situation. So getting my head around performing, first of all, was not something I could easily get my head around.
Right.
I was in this kind of weird place with everything, and then
closed down. We're all closed down, aren't we?
Closed down. And I feel it is getting worse. It feels like it's getting worse. It's not. It doesn't feel like it's getting better for me because our industry has been shut down. Yeah. So when I got this offer, I was both scared and also excited because the Opera House gave me a glimmer of positivity, some hope, some light. They said, come here and do what you do. But then I was like, but oh, wait a minute, you want me to do it to no one? Like, you know, even when I rehearse and do sound checks, I'm performing to the poor person who's putting the electricity together in the wings, or someone who's doing the, you know, sometimes I peek at the sound check and then I have nothing for the show. It's a thing. So this was the thing. I arrived at the Opera House, greeted by very lovely, warm security men at the stage door. I drowned myself in sanitizer. I had to take my own water and my own food because there was nothing there. That, like, you know, I've worked in the Opera House many, many times. Yeah. I've been very fortunate. I've played in literally every single room in that place, including outside the Opera House. The only place I haven't played is the roof. I went in there and the place was empty. There was no one around. The lights were all up. The smell of sanitizer in the air. I went to my dressing room. There was no one around. All the corridors were empty. Everything was brightly lit. Jeremy Brennan, who played the piano, was in another part of the Opera House. I didn't even know where he was. And I couldn't even say, hooroo, how you going?
Yeah, right.
Then I was, you know, 1.5, someone came to say, you're going to do your sound check now. I went up into the Joan Sutherland Opera Theatre. My microphone was in a plastic bag. there was a man wiping the mic stand and the area around the microphone with sanitizer. No one came near me. There were cameras all over the place. I couldn't even see them. I couldn't even see the people or the cameras. There was a giant clock at the in the stalls, and an electric clock which was going to count down every second to let me know, because I had a limited time. I had to do 45 minutes and I couldn't do anything over. But I also couldn't stop, because even though there was no one there, I had to be a live performance.
How surreal. So
it was very strange. And then I remember being in my dressing room and I was getting really nervous, because I thought, my whole thing is about an audience.
Yeah.
Whether they hate me or love me, it's about an exchange.
Yeah.
You know, and I've worked to hostile rooms.
Mm-hmm.
So even that is an interesting experience, as opposed to nobody. And then, of course, they insisted on having the lights up in the theatre, so I kept seeing the empty seats.
Yes.
It was difficult. I won't say that it was. I kind of had to do sort of like play. I had to sort of in my own head, which we do, performers do this. We have this ability to kind of shift the reality. Started seeing a full house.
Wow.
And I started seeing people reacting. This started to kick in about halfway. I mean, I kind of did this comedy send-up of channeling.
You do. You were channeling Joan Sutherland.
But although that comes across as a joke, it actually is a little bit partially truth. Anytime I perform, whatever it is, whether it's a concert, cabaret or play, I always pray before I go on. I pray to the traditional owners. I ask their permission quietly, privately. I ask them that I can be there on their land to say those stories, to say these stories. But I also pray to the spirits of the people who've passed, the people who played on those venues, whether it's an old theatre or a modern theatre, opera house or not. I always try and key in to those spirits that I believe are there. They are there, that's their home, and I ask them to work with me in this thing I'm about to do. Can I have their support? I need their support to do this traditional ancient thing. And that opera house show, I started to like hallucinate, I guess, in a sense. I started to see people. I started to see a full, and they were all listening and watching me.
Do you think that's a part of the performer in you, that, or as a performer, you are transporting an audience and you are, you know, transported yourself in?
Yes, that's a good, very good point. I think that's right. I think
you are basically carrying the audience, really.
Mm. You know, I had to also, because I'm not a television person. I'm not a media person. I've never been trained in anything, so I don't know. And also part of me is not interested in that either, because I see that all the time. Every time I see on TV, I see shiny trained people, media people always saying the right things. And they know how to speak. They know how to make their voice sound, whatever. I'm not interested. I love the danger and the chaos of the theatre. I love that it's unhinged, because to me that's life.
If you were going to give any advice before we go to anyone wanting to pursue a career in entertainment or survive as a creative, and maybe, you know, outside of this kind of strange and very dark time that we're in, just generally, what would you say?
First of all, I'd say never give up. Get a job. Whatever you need to do to earn money, in terms of pay your rent, to pay your bills, look after yourself, your health. And thirdly, I'd probably say to you, learn to live frugally.
Good advice.
Learn to live simply. You need to learn a way to be happy with simple things and be grateful for the simple things. And Patti Smith, who's one of my heroes, she says this later in her life. She says, you know, treating yourself with good health is how you survive. You can't really make your life easy if you're allowing yourself to indulge in any kind of addictions like drugs and alcohol and those sorts of things, because they do get in the way. You learn from these things. You learn from the past. You learn from the history, you know, to how to survive with nothing or little, because there's only a few who really break through, who really go to the stratospheres, especially in Australia. I mean, I've had an extraordinary career, regardless of the fact I'm not known, but I've managed to keep working and to keep being given incredible opportunities. You know, just recently I did, I worked with the Sydney Theatre Company, and I played Mr. Miller in the Terence Rattigan classic, The Deep Blue Sea.
And I got to work with,
because each and every experience is gold. I still think those early days when I was unsure, when I was being involved in community theatre and amateur musical society shows. Of course, you're never paid for those things, but you dedicate your time to them and you work with a group of people and you're all there for the same reason, to give the gift of a performance, to tell a story. And you learn when you have to perform a whole piece of theatre in front of five people.
Yeah. You have, yes, or you in have, front of none.
Or in front of none. And it's interesting because I have performed a whole show to five people.
Mm.
And you go, as I did in the Opera House when I started, you know, hallucinating and seeing people in the theatre, in that room, when you see five people looking at you, go, those five people went to the effort of coming to that theatre. They got a bus, they got a ferry, they went through the rain, they had their umbrellas, they spent their pension, they spent their hard-earned cash from their work. They came to see you play, to do what you do. They are valuable. There will never be a technology that can match the live experience.
No.
It's not going to happen. Don't, you know, there's no replacement for it.
No. No, and I would have to disagree. I think you are known, Paul Capsis. And I recall one particular moment, and I don't remember what it was in, but it was some performance at the Seymour Centre, I think, and it was some cabaret or something, and there is something in you that is just bigger than Ben-Hur when you're on stage, and it is not just you. It makes everyone feel bigger than Ben-Hur to be in that live room and to feel that, you know, the energy of a great performer and such, with such an amazing energy. Paul Capsis, thank you so much for joining me.
Regina, it's been marvellous. Thank you.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks so much.
Hello, and you are listening to Stages, and that was the wonderful Paul Capsis. I'll leave you with a little track by him. But before we go, I mentioned that we are here at 2SER doing an antenna fundraiser. We lost it and we are raising funds to replace that much needed essential antenna. So if you can, please do get online at 2ser.com and donate anything. It's tax deductible and it'll help us. And we thank you all so much for everyone that has so far been able to make a donation to help us out. A big shout out to you. I'm Regina Botros. This has been Stages. We'll be back next week with more goings on in the theatre world.
Such a perfect day. I'm glad I spent it with you. Oh, such a perfect day. You keep me hanging on. Keep me hanging on. Just a perfect day. Problems all left alone.